Okay, are we ready to go?
I think we are.
Brilliant. Good evening, everyone. Hello. Just in case you don't happen to be in the UK, good morning, good afternoon, whatever time might be. Glad to see that people are connecting. Welcome to this Policy in Practice seminar. As you guys know, this is a very unique School of Public Policy activity. The idea is not to talk about books, not to talk about theories, not to talk about econometric estimations. It is to talk about what it is like to carry out policy and to hear it from people who've done policy work at the highest levels. And you know, we've had some very good guests over the last couple of years. We've had some very good guests this year. And tonight we have an especially good guest, not only because she is hugely qualified, but also because she is now a member of the School of Public Policy. I think you've probably all met her, but just in case you haven't, Professor of Practice Vanessa Rubio Márquez is with us, and she is our guest this evening. Vanessa has been a professor of practice at the school officially since the 1st of January, although I think she only got her visa papers and officially her email account last week. So as of last week, she's, you know, we can call her an LSE, a member of the LSE community. I'm sure you probably read some of the material that we circulated about Vanessa, but just in case you didn't, let me tell you a bit more about her, and she will tell quite a bit about herself. She has a very rare privilege. I think she's the only person in Mexico, and certainly the only woman in Mexico, to have been the Deputy Minister of Finance, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, and the Deputy Minister for Social Policy in Mexico. So, you know, those are three of the most important cabinet posts in the country. You know, the fourth would be for the Mexicans, present gobernación, but that's a bad guy who deals with the cops, right? You wouldn't want to have that job. But all the three interesting, glamorous, and intellectually challenging ministries, Vanessa was an important person in all three. And if we think about the kinds of things that we think about in at the SPP, you know, it's not a bad description to say that we think about economic and financial policy, we think about social policy, and we think about global policy. And again, Vanessa was involved in all of those. She was also somebody who didn't just do public policy from the executive arm. She also got involved in real life electoral politics. She ran a presidential campaign at the national level in Mexico, and I'm sure she will tell you more about it. She also managed to get herself elected to the Mexican Senate. I am particularly impressed about that because I tried to be elected to the Chilean Senate and I was 800 votes short. So I'm guessing Vanessa probably got a lot more votes than I did. So my hat is off to you. Congratulations. So the idea, guys, is very, very simple. We're going to give the floor to Vanessa. She's going to tell us a little bit, sort of, you know, very directly, what it's like to do policy, what she learned, what she wished she had, you know, learned earlier, what are the challenges, what are the things that she would like to share with you. Then I will ask, you know, I will take my chair's privilege and ask three or four questions of her, and then just open it up so that you guys can actually go after her with questions, queries, objections to anything she might have said, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'll just add that Vanessa and I spent much of the afternoon on a call. We're part of a new task force to reform the international economic architecture with, you know, some very senior people, former central bank presidents, central bank governors, ministers, deputy prime ministers, et cetera, et cetera. I was, again, hugely impressed by what she had to say in that meeting, and I think she will be playing a very important role in that, among other things. So, again, if we want to know what it's like not just to talk about policy, but to actually carry out policy reforms, Vanessa Rubio is the person to turn to. We are very, very lucky to have her as a professor of practice at the school. And one more thing, maybe I should have begun here, but I will say it now anyway. in Mexico and in Latin America, she is also well known for being a very persuasive advocate for women's empowerment, women's presence in public policy and in the public arena. And that's something also that we think a lot about and is very important in the mission of the school. So yet one more thing that Vanessa can tell us about. Vanessa, over to you. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. I see that Tony has joined. Welcome, Tony. You know, let's have an informal conversation, nothing too formal, but Vanessa can provide some introductory remarks to get us going.
Thank you so much, Andres. I feel like I am the lucky one to be here at the School of Public Policy, to be back at my alma mater, where I did my master's degree, and to be here with all of you and be able to share my experiences with you from what Andres was mentioning, over 25 years in Mexico's public sector. So I hope and I can keep up to the expectations that Andres has set with the reading of my curriculum. It's weird, and you're going to feel this way when you yourselves are you know, policymakers. When they read your CV, you feel like they're speaking about someone else and not yourself. Like I am just Vanessa, Agustin's wife, and you know, the daughter of Ophelia and the sister of Valeria, and that's the way I see myself. But at the end, you engage in public policy, you engage in careers, you work a lot, you commit yourself to public policy, and you end up having a long career, which I am really appreciative and thankful and humbled for. So I will try to give you an idea of how these 25 years were for me. I started in 1994 in foreign affairs. I joined the ministry. I joined the team that made Mexico's accession to the OECD. And I think that this marked my career and this marked my milieu as a public servant, because that's the year when Mexico changed dramatically. And Mexico changed dramatically, not only as a result of being a part of the OECD. The OECD back then had been a closed organization. It was considered to be, you know, the developed countries organization. Also, you know, there were a series of standards that Mexico was new to. Everybody wanted to know who Mexico was, because obviously they hadn't seen anyone new for more than 20 years. So it was a very interesting process, but at the same time, Mexico had the new free trade agreement with the US and Canada. We were opening up our economy. We are engaged in topics such as competition, the participation of international and domestic private sector in the economy, export-oriented economy and an open economy. We were having for the first time an independent central bank, independent and technical organizations to do the checks and balances in the economy. We had the floating exchange rate. So all of this meant that Mexico was changing a lot, and that the OECD was part of the change, but that was also promoting the change to happen. I remember the first document they gave to me when I sat in my desk. It was funny because I sat at the desk, they told me, okay, sit there. And I sat at the desk thinking that someone would be sitting at the desk and interview me. But I had already got the position and I didn't know that. And when someone got there, was like, why are you sitting there? You know, like a visiting person, this is your office. And I was, oh, okay, I should go the other way around. This is my office, no? I was really excited about having the position. I competed with 10 or 12 other young people. And it was the first position you can get in public administration. And one thing I always think that I am very humbled by and I value a lot is that I was able to get every single position within the public administration ladder. And that teaches you so much, no? You can be, you know, very, very successful and perhaps lucky to sometimes jump from one, you know, place to two next steps or do some leapfrogging. But in my case, it was so So, you know, humbling, but also very illustrative to be in every single position under until I was three times the deputy minister. So it was a great thing to have. My battery is running out. Just hold on a second. Here we are. So yeah, I think that was something that I value a lot, and that was a landmark in my career. So part of what Mexico was changing now was what I call the station of Mexico. So it was the democratization of Mexico, the institutionalization of Mexico, the privatization process in Mexico, and the liberalization process. All of this was the context in which I joined public policy making in Mexico. And as I said, it was a great experience to see the firsthand that change in my country. And the OECD obviously implied that many of the different committees, you know, the OECD looks into things like trade, but also finance, but also migration and women and integration. So it's a very varied specialized forum, like a think tank of think tanks. So it was very interesting to be the liaison between the organization and the Mexican government, which, by the way, wasn't used to being asked for information, for systematized information, for opening up the statistics, explaining how the statistics were made. I remember the first time that I took people from the economic committee to the Central Bank of Mexico, they were like, so why do you want my statistics? Where are you going to put them? What do you want them for? No, we weren't used to that. So that was my first experience in foreign affairs. Then I will speak about my second love in public policy, which is finance. And basically I joined International Finance. It was in the year 2000. And it was marvelous to be able, not only with my background of the OECD, but this time to look into the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and all the development banks worldwide in which Mexico participated. Central America, South America, the Caribbean, Asia, Europe. So it gave me a lot of sense of the international financial architecture, how you construct positions for those international fora, how relevant it is. I always told this to my students in Mexico, to represent your country. It's a very special position to be in, which is to see, you know, the sign of Mexico and know that you're behind the sign of Mexico. And whenever you ask for the word, it's Mexico speaking. So it's such a responsibility to carry forward. You need to prepare this with your team. You need to prepare this, obviously, with your bosses and make sure that you're speaking for your country and that you're that catalyzing box, if I may put this in systemic analysis, that gets all the inputs from the private sector, from the social sector, from the different stakeholders, from the government, and be able to put forward a position that speaks for your country and negotiate for your country and make decisions for your country. And sometimes I was in a position where I shouldn't take the decision. I was only advising those making the decisions. But in others, I was the one and I was the final decision maker for my country. And you have that weight on your shoulders and you can actually feel it, no? You start getting more massages each time, like back massages and and things like that, no? So I was very, very grateful about this possibility of getting into knowing the nuances and the process of public policy making when you prepare a position for international financial organizations. And obviously, one other thing that is relevant, obviously, is to move, which was my case within the Ministry of Finance, from representing Mexico in international financial organizations to doing domestic finance, which is what I did when I was Deputy Minister of Finance. I was the first woman to ever be Deputy Minister of Finance in my country in over 100 years. It's something that I'm grateful and that I am humbled of, but at the same time, honestly, it was the 21st century. I thought of this cannot be happening in the 15th economy in the world, no? Why am I the first person, the first woman to hold this position? And we have never had a woman who hold the Ministry of Finance. But still, I think there are some sectors, and the financial sector is one, that I would not speak about the glass ceiling, but rather like a cement ceiling. No, it's really difficult to move forward. And you feel that and you perceive that. At some point, I was sitting with the National Bankers Association, for example. It was a meeting, and I am not exaggerating, of around 60 people. I was the only woman in the whole room. Those things are, I mean, you cannot be blind. You see that, you perceive that, no? And you get away with it, and you're capable, and you're experienced, and you are in that chair for a reason. But it's things that you see and you don't want them to repeat again, because you know that at least half of the population has the skills, the possibilities, the knowledge, but they just need the right opportunities and the right access to rights, no? So I think that's also important, because you perceive that the whole time you're working in this kind of context. Being the first woman to hold that position also, it meant that the bar was really high, the expectations were high, the stakes were high, and they were higher than if I was a man. So I needed to prove that I was able to accomplish the job, but that I was a woman that was able to accomplish the job for the first time. And you obviously have that pressure, because you don't want to be like the first woman and not being able to carry out, you know, the work properly, but that adds on to your pressure as a, you know, as a public policymaker. So my economic context, when I stepped in as Deputy Minister of Finance, was September 2016. A change had taken place due to political reasons in Mexico. I didn't expect that. So from one day to the other, I moved from being Deputy Minister of Social Affairs to being Deputy Minister of Finance. It was 72 hours before having to defend the annual budget in the legislative. So I had 72 hours to learn the whole budget, to be able to defend it, and to go to the Deputy's chamber and to the Senate chamber, first to be approved to be the Deputy Minister of Finance, and then to present the budget. Obviously, I didn't sleep for the 72 hours, no? I studied a lot, I did my best, but at the same time, I just wanted you to know that I was carrying this weight of delivering, no? Due to all the expectations that were built. If you look at, I mean, even if you Google those years in Mexico, all the headlines are the first woman to hold the position, the first woman to hold the position, and obviously that implies an additional responsibility. So the economic context was basically a drop of 40% of oil prices. Pemex, obviously not Pemex, the national oil company, the sixth largest oil company in the world, was under unviable circumstances. It's still like that right now, but that was a pretty interesting juncture. We had pressured public finances, and we have had already 3 months of harsh electoral process in the US that had disanchored Mexican stability due to the fact that the main narrative against Mexico back then from Donald Trump was that they would get out of NAFTA. And NAFTA is the major anchor of certainty in Mexico, still nowadays. The USMCA is now, but NAFTA was as well. So just imagine the context. And it was not a question of if they were going to downgrade us, but when they were going to downgrade us. So one thing in my mind that I set as a priority, I don't know how naive I was, but I said, I am not going to sit in this chair and be downgraded by the credit rating agency. I don't know what I have to do, but I will do that and more. And basically, I was a very strict policymaker in the fiscal stance. I gathered almost every week with the markets, no, with basically with Wall Street and with Mexico, trying to tell them the right story about how Mexico can get back on track. And it was a feasible story, and it was a convincing story because it was based on facts and on the possibility that we can, you know, build back Pemex again. We can create a Pemex business plan that you know, investors and markets were interested in, and that could create the right conditions to regain a market access and to have a fiscal consolidation in the coming years, no, with a very strict plan for that year and the coming next years. So basically, we were successful in doing that. We didn't get the downgrade, and we were able to pass the electoral process and the first days of the U.S. administration. And I can speak on public finances in the Q&As maybe. Then I'll move to social development just for some minutes. Social development gave me the possibility, first of all, of knowing my country firsthand. One thing that I think was a great lesson is you cannot be a public policy maker in your office. I mean, you can now due to COVID because you cannot go out, but in normal circumstances, you need to go out there. You need to see the small towns in your country. You need to see the big cities. You need to see the differences in your country. You need to see the poor people. You need to see the difference between extreme poor and poor, which is very marked and it's very sharp, and they need different things and they need different public policy responses. So I think that was one thing that I appreciated a lot, and being able to put my intellectual capabilities to serving the possibility of reducing poverty in my country. After a year, I was Deputy Minister of Social Development, an independent body that measures multidimensional poverty in Mexico, Coneval, measured 2 million people that came out of the condition of extreme poverty. Those are the things when you are a public servant that fill your life and fill your heart. You go to bed and you say, I couldn't do like the 7.5 million, but just imagining in my head that 2 million people, due to the work that the team developed throughout a year at the ministry, we were able to move people, 2 million people out of this unbearable, you know, unacceptable condition of extreme poverty is something that you really feel that you have contributed to the world and to your country, no? And obviously, poverty is a very complex issue. You have, you know, you have the social affairs, you have the context, you have economic policy, you have multi-dimension of poverty, you have access to basic social rights. But being such a complex and such a rich policy, what I found that was quite exciting is that you have the possibility of getting people out of extreme poverty and out of poverty. And I saw it with my eyes, and with the proper policies and with the proper support by the government to accompany the efforts is something you can do. And I'm sure it can be done worldwide. And finally, I would say that I made a huge transition in my life. I had always been a public servant, and then I became a politician when I jumped to the presidential campaign. I was there for 6 months. It was overwhelming, it was complex, it was unexpected for me, it was intricate, but it was a great experience. It taught me a lot about myself. It taught me a lot about Mexican politics. It taught me a lot about my country. And I was able to see, I see clearly how Mexico can move or cannot move forward, no? What's the right way and what's the wrong way in terms of politics in my country. And as a result of that, we lost the election, we lost the presidential election. The candidate that I worked for, Pepe Mit, lost the election, and I became a senator and legislated and participated in political debates and in legislative debates for almost 2 years. I presented more than 20 initiatives. Two of them are now a reality, are laws in Mexico. One of them, and I am very glad to be able to say it, is that now we have the mandate of having a gender equality in the boards of all the development banks in Mexico for the first time. Mm-hmm. And since that law was enacted, we passed from 1 woman to 17 women being in the boards of the development banks in Mexico. So those are the kind of things that you see that at some point they were in your mind, then they were on a paper, then they were discussed by your team, then they were implemented, and now they're reality, and they're, you know, life changers, not for those women only that are chairing, that are members of the board, but the women that they are favoring with the policies and the programs aimed at women having access to the financial system. So basically, I am really humbled, I am really happy and delighted to be here with you, to be part of the SPP. Count on me, as Andres said, I now have an email, you can contact me, we can discuss your future plans, we can discuss anything you might have in mind. I'm eager to have a contact with you, to be able to give you input, orient you, give you my experiences, and please feel free to reach out. I'll be more than happy to engage with you through obviously these kind of activities, but obviously one-on-one as well. So I'll leave my first comments here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vanessa. That was great. That was inspiring. I really like many things, but one thing in particular that you said toward the end, I think what's special about being a policymaker, and I suspect many people on the call will agree, is that you think about it, you work on it, and sometimes, not always, it actually happens, you know, it comes into being. And you see, you know, you see the law being passed, or you see the subsidies being distributed, you know, and the things that at some point were just, you know, a piece of paper or a number or a folder on your desk. You know, I remember being a minister and like designing a new housing subsidy, and then during the financial crisis actually going to a poor part of Chile and actually handing out the subsidies, you know, meeting the people who'd get the subsidy and who'd get a new house. And you know, it sort of brings home the difference between being an academic or being an analyst and actually being a policymaker that makes policy. And policy, you know, not all the time, but if you get lucky and if you do things well, makes a difference in people's lives. I'm going to use chair's privilege and just ask two or three questions, and then please begin to think of your intervention, guys. Let me begin by the end. You talked about your transition between policymaking and politics, and you said something that rang a bell with me, that you know, you learn about politics, but you also learn about yourself. What struck you about politics that is so different from being an appointed official? You know, what or the way people carry themselves, the way business is transacted, the way you have to explain or not explain things. What's the biggest difference between the two that you could share with the students?
Of course, one thing that I found was quite different is that in when you're a public policy maker, you think for yourself, you work for the goals of the organization you're working for, but in terms of the transactionality, no, it's quite different to politics. Mm-hmm. In politics, you might think, you know, one thing, but if your constituency thinks otherwise, you would have to engage in negotiations. Mm-hmm. And sometimes for me, it was difficult to negotiate the way I thought. Let me put an example to you. I was within my constituency, first of all, I was not a member of the party. Mm-hmm. I am not a member of any party in Mexico, and this is my decision. Mm-hmm. And but I was part of a constituency of one of the big parties, the PRI. Okay. So when they tell you, let's think about how we all the senators think about a certain topic. We were 14 senators. and everybody thinks one way, and you know, the discussions are nice, but then along comes unity, and it's, and then you're told, okay, that's fine, and we had a great discussion, but we are voting against because that's in the best interest of the party. Yeah. Oh, there I had some problems because I, since I was not a member of the party, I couldn't understand what was within that catalyzing box of the party that was its best interest. Mm. And then in the second part, yes, I was blamed to be the technocrat of the group, and I was the technocrat of the group. And sometimes they would ask me, you have to be more a politician and less a technocrat. Yeah. And I'll put a very specific example. One of the ideas my group had was to propose cutting taxes to half. I was the deputy minister of finance. I couldn't support something like that because I know it was not good for Mexico. Mm-hmm. But they said, well, but it's a popular measure, and we need popular measures because we need to gain the trust for, you know, of the population, and we need votes. But at the same time, I was, you know, thinking in, by myself, saying, I cannot put forward a proposal signed with my name saying that I agree with cutting taxes by half, no? So those are the kind of things, and that those are the transactional negotiations that sometimes you're willing to do, but sometimes you have fundamental, you know, feelings about it, and you think differently.
Surely rings a bell, both things you said. I remember the first time I went to the Chilean Congress as a minister, I had my PowerPoint, I presented a bill. A number of the members of the committee from the opposition all came up to me afterwards and they said, oh, brilliant bill, good presentation, clear PowerPoint, you know, what a good idea. And then they all voted against. So I said, how come? You know, you told me you liked the bill. Why are you voting against? And they said, of course we're voting against. We're part of the opposition. Oppositions vote against. That's what oppositions do, right? So, you know, the concept of persuasion when it comes to politics is very different than persuasion in regular life or persuasion in academic life, et cetera. I'm sure, Vanessa, that you still wake up at 3 a.m. and you think of the scariest or the tensest moment you had in government. You know, if you ask me, I think back to say the world financial crisis, you know, around being there, you know, like 3 days without sleep thinking, oh shit, what's going to happen now? What is the one moment that you know, you wake up at 3 a.m. and you think, oh my God, I can't believe I was in that position and I can't believe that I survived. Tell us about your worst moment. Tell us about your happiest moment too, when you got something done and you thought, my God, I never thought I'd get that done and it was done and how happy I am.
My happiest moment was definitely when we were able to build hundreds of community food places for people without the basic right, which is access to food, mm-hmm. access to nutrition. And we counted a million hot meals every day in those places. And one trip I made to one of those places, I didn't expect that. But as a result, it was a very poor community and the best construction was the place we built. Mm-hmm. And they had a terrible storm the previous day. Mm-hmm. And the person that was in charge of the food place thought, you know, all these little houses are going to fall apart due to this storm. Why don't I open the place and I let everybody inside the, you know, this building, and all of the little town was saved and we had no casualties. And then I thought, well, these places that we built for people to eat during the day should serve other purposes in the afternoon and at night. So then we developed a different concept of those places being also for catastrophes and for learning activities in the afternoons.
So that's the best moment. Tell us about the tensest moment, the most worrying moment, that one that kept you up at night, you know, for days at a time.
I think it was the election day in the US, mm-hmm. Because we were at what we called the war room. Mm-hmm. The war room was constituted by the Minister of Finance, the Central Bank Governor, mm-hmm. Agustín Carstens, who's today the head of the BIS, the three deputies of finance, and the person in charge of communications. And we were monitoring in different screens the election. Mm-hmm. And when we saw the result of the election, I was the one that prepared what we called the red folder. And the red folder was like break up in a case of an emergency and what to do minute one, minute two, minute 10, minute 20, regarding in order to keep the markets functioning well and not to have a huge hit on volatility in Mexico. So I had prepared the speech for the minister. I had prepared the interactions we had to do with the markets. And we had prepared for a series of measures like if we were administering a crisis. So it was basically that. I didn't sleep at all. We ended up in the war room at 5 a.m. And I told the central bank governor and the minister of finance, okay, I wait for you here at 7:15 because that's where the markets in Asia, in the United States and Mexico open at the same time. And we need to address them at this point. So we took a shower in our respective homes, came back. And when I was, getting to the ministry, I saw someone that was in a bicycle selling bread. And he was starting his day opening his selling of the bread. And when I saw him, I was like, I cannot fail because if I fail, this man will not be able to sell the bread anymore. And it was a very emotional moment because you know how many people depend on you taking the right decisions for your country.
Yeah, it's a very, very big sense of responsibility. And there you have it, people on the call. The biggest shock to Mexico was not Mexico. The biggest shock to Mexico was Donald Trump. Sound familiar? One last question, Vanessa, and I'll turn it over to the students. You were a student at the LSE, then you went into public service in Mexico. What is the one thing you wish you had learned when you were a student that would have proven really useful when you became a policymaker?
I would say conceptually, and I am advertising my course. Hopefully that will be available for next term. I would say conceptually, it would have been a toolbox on how your mind should work when you're creating public policy. So like understanding what the problem is, understanding what kind of a solution you have to give, right. But then all the different steps, no? How are you going to be communicating? How are you going to be building alliances to moving it forward? How are you going to be considering to engage every single stakeholder? How are you going to be, analyzing and evaluating the policy and perhaps reconsidering or reformulating it? So that would be like a mental framework that I would like to develop with my students hopefully soon. And in the other hand, I would perhaps say how important it is to be prepared to communicate well. Most of the policies that do not have success, or many of the policies that are unsuccessful, you can look into communication challenges that weren't, approached in the right way.
Indeed. I mean, an engineer might say that you're solving a technical constraint, the policy has to be good, but there's a political constraint, there's a communications constraint, there is the implementation constraint. Sometimes, ministers give orders and then nothing happens, as one learns very, very quickly. So, all right, I've done enough talking. I'm going to shut up now. I hear there are a few questions in the chat and I'm just going to invite people to ask them directly. I don't have to be your mouthpiece. So I see Hector and Hasty have asked questions. So guys, please turn on your microphones and ask them directly, please.
Thank you, Andres. Thank you, Vanessa. My question is regarding a topic that we are analyzing in the course of Professor Adnan Khan and Timothy Wesley, that is the the conflicts in the relation between the principal and the agent. And the question is very concrete. Do you have any story or experience in your career when you had to take over a position and you you had resisted from the bureaucracy, the bureaucratic body? For the example that Andres said recently, when you make an order with the policy of the government, and you have a culture that resists that instruction. Yeah.
Excellent question, Hector. And my answer is yes. And it is very common. And I would tell you two different occasions in which that happened. First of all, it was when I worked for the OECD. You had back then in 1994, the ministry divided into two different mindsets. Those who thought that it was a huge mistake to join the OECD and that we should have kept on, you know, aligning with the G77, we actually were forced by the, you know, the constituency of the OECD to resign to the G77. And that was a huge thing for many Mexican diplomats that, you know, were from that line of thought beforehand. So yes, that was one of it. I mean, and you had those that worked for you and that hated the OECD, no? And we had to do something because we said, I understand and that you can have an objection of conscience, no, here, but you cannot work for our organization you don't like and you don't believe in and that you think you're wasting our time, no? So yes, that was one. And the other experience that I would point would be in social development. Social policy is very likely to be politicized because politicians think that it's the best option to create a political base for them. And when you think differently, when perhaps you're considered a technocrat, as I was, you don't care at that point about the votes. You don't care about, you're just caring about bringing people out of poverty and, you know, doing the right policies, the social policies, and getting the right transfers for them and access to water, sanitization, education, health, no? So I felt a huge setback from the bureaucracy in the Ministry of Social Development that were used to politicizing social policy. And I think that that still exists, unfortunately. Unfortunately for social policy and unfortunately for bringing people outside this condition of poverty and extreme poverty. That is something that I discussed a lot with the World Bank. And I think it's something that has to be resolved and discussed globally, not domestically, because the domestic context will always have people pulling towards having a social policy aligned with political interests. And I think we have to divorce that if we want to have a good social policy implemented in our countries.
Sorry, just a little, how did you overcome that resistance? Mm-hmm. Because Professor Timothy Vesely suggests that sometimes you need to fire some people in the organizations.
Which is basically what I did. and they were by the dozens.
Yeah.
So I did that, and obviously there were some people that were against it, but it was just for me unbelievable that even when you visited a little town in Mexico and you wanted to oversee the social policy, they would create a political event out of your presence there. And I didn't want to be in a political event. And I felt bad about it. You cannot, you know, go and see the people that are, you know, the vulnerable of the vulnerable and the poor of the poor and have a mind to see them as votes. Like that for me is impossible. No, so yes, I had to do that in some ways. And what I did and I think it was a great thing to do in that ministry, was I hired a lot of other technocrats to help me out to implement my view on social policy. So whenever there was someone that had been there for 30 years and he had this, you know, politics embedded into social policy, I said, well, I'd rather, you know, bring someone from Bank of Mexico, from the central bank, to help me out to prepare a good statistics about poverty, for instance, no?
Okay. I'm going to hand it over to Hasty to ask her question in a second, but let me just follow up on that. You're right. Sometimes, you know, these political types are jaded and they're too political and they can, you know, get you into trouble. But didn't you find also that, I'll tell you what my experience was, and let's contrast it a little bit. You know, I ran a ministry with lots of people with degrees from LSE and the Kennedy School and Stanford and Chicago and all kinds of places. And I found that I knew how to do what they knew how to do, so I didn't need them as much. Whereas I found that I didn't really know how to do the political side. So I needed some of those political types. And I relied on them a lot because the political types would take me aside and say, "Minister, careful, don't do that, don't say that. You know, watch out for this guy, he's going to stab you in the back." So I'm sure you fired some of the political types, but I'm sure you kept some of the political types because they kept you alive, didn't they?
Totally. No. And don't misunderstand me here. I totally think that it's a great opportunity to build differentiated and diverse groups for working together towards a common purpose. And I had, you know, political types and I had technocratic types. Yeah. The only thing here was those who saw social policy with political lens, you know, they saw people, they didn't see people in poverty, they see votes.
Right.
And they exchanged social policy for votes. Right. That's illegal.
Yeah.
That's where I put the red line. Yeah. The red line was when it turns into something illegal, because you cannot view giving away these, for example, putting these centers for development or these centers for food cannot have the logics of votes. So that was the red line that I put, and the red line was exactly what I answered Hector. But the rest, obviously, politicians welcome, sociologists welcome, you know, economists welcome. You didn't have to be a technocrat. You just have to have you just needed to want to end poverty, not to get votes out of poverty. That was the difference.
Clientelism, that's what these guys were doing. It's a very tricky and risky thing. All right. I promise now this time I will shut up. Hasty, over to you.
Thank you for the opportunity. I wanted to know, so as a policy administrative aspirant, I want to join the public service in my country, but what, on your experiences, what do you suggest that students who want to join the public service should do after their master's immediately? Should they directly join the public service, or is it better to join the private sector, get some experience of that sort, and then, you know, shift the career? Or how do you see what kind of experiences have helped you the most in your journey? Thank you.
Thank you, Hasti. I think they work both. And one thing I think I have learned is that you have to have plans and you have to have options, but then you have to also let go and see what the future lies for you, no? If you would have told me, 25 years ago when I was, or 27 years ago when I was at the LSE, do you imagine yourself as Deputy Minister of Social Development? I just wouldn't have thought of it. And it was a fascinating experience. So I would say that you should have plan A, plan B, and plan C. You work hard for the three of them, and then let things happen. Because there's no recipe for success. What I would say is that diverse experiences are always very relevant for whatever you are going to be doing. So if you enter the public sector, you're going to be very valuable in the private sector. If you enter the private sector, you're going to be very valuable in the public sector, no? So that, and if you enter an international organization, you're going to be valued by the private sector and by the public sector. So if I would be you, if you don't have like a straight mind of where you want to go, I would consider A, B, and C. And then see how does it move forward, no? If you're hired by the private sector, then I'm sure you're going to be having possibilities in the public and in the international institutions afterwards, no? And see how the, you know, the future lies for you. But I would still have plans and then, you know, follow the, you know, possibilities and opportunities. We can't hear you, Andres.
I muted myself, sorry. I was saying that, yes, one has to make plans, but in politics, you know, what's the cliche? A week is a very long time, right? So who knows what the future will bring. I can see a number of hands up. Sami, and then Juan Eduardo.
Yes, thank you, Andres. Thank you, Vanessa, for sharing with us your experience, inspiring experience. I have a lot of questions here. Okay, my first one is about your transition between the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Social Development. What were the main drivers there? Because I have, well, my previous experiences in the Ministry of Finance in Peru, and I think it's a totally different mindset. And you're thinking always in fiscal consolidation on the debt and the rating. So I'm moving to another different minister. Then my second question is about how do you deal with the male-oriented mindset that we have in Latin America, especially in the public sector? And the third one is about management. As a deputy minister, what elements do you consider important to foster the motivation in the public servants? And yes, to support this commitment of the people you are working with. Thank you.
Thank you, Sami. Very interesting questions, all of them. I believe that you can be a professional policymaker, regardless of what policy is in front of you. So as long as you know how to address a problem, consider a solutions or a set of solutions, and address them through public policy or through public policy options, you can do finance, you can do social development, you can do environment. Obviously, there's a specialization that all of us get. My specialization is finance and it's international. But what policy does not touch in finance, no? So when you want to do social policy, you have to have, you know, the numbers. You have to have, you know, budgetary resources to do it, you know? So I think that being in public policy and being a public policy maker gives you a very transversal experience of policies. When you were in finance, I am sure you touched 10 or 12 different other policies. So it would be interesting how you can move from finance to one of the policies you touched when you were in finance, and you would be able to have it with a different perspective. And as Andres was saying, when you go there, you're going to have experts on that. You're going to have experts. If you go to environment, you're going to have environmental experts. If you go to social development, you're going to have social development experts. But at the same time, you're going to have a vision more oriented to financial affairs or to fiscal affairs or to budgetary affairs that would be quite helpful for that. No, so I truly believe that you can be a professional policymaker despite your specialization on specific aspects. In terms of the male-oriented mindset, I would say it's a question of, first of all, in terms of your own positioning, always think about you as the best person that can be seated in that chair, regardless of whether you're a woman or you're a man. I always say that we are going to be transcending gender when we don't think if we have it in front a woman or a man, but we have a professional in front of us, no? A capable human being that is working in your team or that is your colleague or, so I think that's how you should behave towards the rest, no? And then when you are able to be, you know, to set trends and to set opportunities for the rest, do them, no? Create the opportunities, create the environment conducive for women to participate, for women to compete for the positions, for women to be included. So that's something that I think is relevant, no? To do both things, the way you view yourself, but also the way you engage other women to be part of the teams and to have opportunities, no? The legislation that I passed that I was referring to is very clear, no? There were women there, there were capable women there. They just didn't have the opportunity to be seated on the chair, no? And now you have 16 instead of one. So that's the kind of things that I think should be done more oftenly. And in terms of fostering motivation in you know, the managerial aspects of leadership, I would say that two very important things. When you have a team, the team needs to know what the goal is. When I worked in that first step that I told you about, it's called head of department, no? I was writing speeches. And then all of the sudden, my boss was Gurría, current head of the OECD. So they would pass me on the document saying, no, Gurría didn't like your speech. You need to change it. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, but how do I change it, no? Why don't you tell me what he didn't like, no? Or what things are good, what things are wrong. So knowing how does that work, now when I was deputy minister, what I did was a very horizontal leadership. It is very common, and it is very common in emerging markets and developing markets to have very vertical structures. So the minister only sees the deputy. The deputy only sees, you know, the director generals. What I did was, who did this? Mm-hmm. The head of department. Okay, bring the head of department, bring the deputy director, bring the director, and we're all going to be working. Mm-hmm. And my meeting room was characterized always by being, you know, very messy in terms of documents and lots of people getting it in and out, because I wanted the person that was writing the document to know what the strategy was, to know what we were working for. And if there was a huge change, which they might happen sometimes because you're in the middle of a position negotiating the USMCA and you were saying okay to sugar, and then the next day you're, no, we're not giving sugar in the negotiation, you need to explain that to the person that is doing the document on sugar. Otherwise, they don't understand what they're making the changes and that what they're working for. So you need to give ownership to your team of the overall strategy and the overall goals you're trying to achieve. And the more horizontal you are, the better. And obviously, in some occasions, I didn't have time to engage with the head of department and with the deputy director. I had to speak only with the director generals. But whenever that was possible, and it was possible many times, I mean, if you're talking to someone, there can be five people listening there. And sometimes I told them, we cannot engage in discussions, but just sit there and listen, because I need you to see what we're discussing. And in some other occasions, we were engaging in discussions about the policies. So I think that would be my piece of advice for you on that.
That's very good advice. That's very good advice. You know, the vertical structure of a lot of governments is a very big hindrance to policymaking. When I was a minister, I would do the same thing you did. I would allow people into my office, and the staffers who had been there for years would say, you know, I've worked in this building for 20 years. I had never been in the minister's office, which struck me as absolutely stupid, right? But that's the way things had been done for years, decades, centuries, I don't know. I can see Juan Eduardo's hand is up. Juan Eduardo, over to you. I can't see any more hands up, but please, guys, prepare your questions. If you'd like to speak up, just do. Don't wait for me to call on you.
Hello, Vanessa. Thank you for sharing your experiences. It's been great. So from your story, it seems like some conditions or some practical practices, like meeting with your staffers or meeting with the people that benefit, seems to change your behavior and how you frame your policies. Any advice on policymakers to have a long career, a long successful career? Maybe things that are really practical practices to be a good policymaker?
Ah, that's a tough one. Thank you. Thank you so much, Juan Eduardo. I think that without falling into what's obvious, you need to work a lot. You need to always be try to be one step or two steps ahead of what your institution or your boss needs or the project you're working on needs. I think that you need to study a lot. Public policies obviously apply to a given context, but I am a huge fan of comparison and of experience sharing. If you are going to be solving a problem in the most little town of Pakistan or the most little town in Mexico or the most little town in Australia, you might have a lot of coincidences. And the possibilities that people in the past have thought about that same problem in a different way or had a different perspective, no? Or that you might have a very good input from international organizations that gather, thinking, and the OECD, the World Bank, the IMF, the, WHO, whatever international organization aims at whatever you're doing, it's also very good to reviewing. Another aspect that I would, there's a lot of policymakers and you want to differentiate yourself for the good reasons. One way of differentiating yourself is because you're knowledgeable and you do the homework. So if everybody's having the same information, try to find some more information. So if you have to do double work to check on international organizations and double work to check what other countries have done in similar circumstances, I think that's a good starting point. And then I think another way to prove useful and to be, it's to have an open mind and to be humble and to listen also to the people that work with you. No, you might have a straight mind of how things should work, but having collective thinking with the people that work in your team, sometimes you're like, okay, I might do some tweaking due to this, or you're right, we were not considering this other aspect, no? And I think the more consultations you make, the more information you get, the broader of a sense you have, and the more confident you will feel, no? The first day I was at the Ministry of Finance, what I did was to call six previous ministers of finance and deputy ministers of finance to ask them, you were here 20 years ago, you were here 10 years ago, the circumstances are quite different. What would you do if you were in my place today? No? And from having that opportunity, those 2 hours that I spent on making those calls, I got a pretty good sense of and a different view perhaps of what my priorities should be, the way I should address some of the most pressing issues. So I think the more information you have, the more people you talk with, you would have a better perspective into looking into things, and you will have something to add to a collectivity that is thinking about the same topic.
Thank you. Thank you, Vanessa. I see lots of hands coming up. I'm not quite sure which order they came up, but I think Domenica was first, then Juan Pablo, then Denny, and then we're going to pass it over to Professor Travers, who would also like to ask a question.
Thank you, Andres, and thank you, Vanessa, for this very insightful conversation. I have a very kind of tough question, but I would like to know because it's really well known, at least from the experience in my country, that when you want to raise in a public sector organization or even engage in politics, there is a lot of corruption going on. So I'm curious if you have faced that and how have you dealt with that? Because I feel many people discourage their participation in the public sector because of that. They don't want to commit their values to that. That's all, thank you.
I am glad that you raised the point, Dominica. I think that corruption exists. I think that corruption will keep on existing. But what we need to do as public servants is, first of all, if you see any act of corruption, you need to speak up, and you need to, if it's in your, you know, in your margins of action and your legal margins of action, you need to do something. I'm going to say something about this in a second. But in the other hand, the best we can do is to build strong and democratic institutions that serve the purposes of checks and balances in order for corruption not to happen. The more authoritarian a state, the more discretionary a state, the more margins for corruption there is. The more internal checks and balances, external checks and balances, agreements internationally, legally binding conditions with international organizations or with treaties, all of that creates a framework for that to be prevented, no? And I think that there was one time that I went to, when I was Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, one of my mandates was the southern border. So that's the border between Mexico and Guatemala and Belize. So I did a trip to the border, and I saw there was like a huge line of people wanting to cross to Mexico from Belize. And there was a short line of people wanting to cross. And we were in the car, and I saw it, and I was like, something is not right there, no? And I told the car to stop, and I went out the car, and I went to see it. When you scale up in the ladder, sometimes when you visit spaces or when you go to events, everything is built so that you see the best of people, that you see the best of things. So I think one thing that is really good to do is like surprise visits, not planned visits, no? Be able to move freely, like I did this time, no? So I just step up the car. Obviously the driver was like, oh, undersecretary, where are you going? Let us, you know, move. No, I was like, no, leave me. I'm just going to see what they're doing. And I asked them why this line is longer than the other. Everybody was quiet, they didn't say anything. And then from the long line, there was a woman that was carrying a little baby, and she approached me and she said, it's because we don't have the money to pay. And I told them, what money to pay for what? And she said, like, to pay for the short line that is in the shadow. And we have to make the long line in the sun to cross the border. So I was like furious, no, obviously I got in, I was Foreign Affairs, and the people in charge there, even though it was the border, they were from migration, from another ministry. So I made calls, I made a huge scandal. Obviously people were fired due to that, no? But at the same time, I mean, the problem of corruption were always going to be there. And in the meantime that you and I are speaking here, maybe those lines are still there. I made a huge fuss and I got someone fired. But what we need is institutions. We need processes. We need good checks and balances, auditing. We need the right incentives for people not to be corrupt, no? So pass from anecdotes to institutional changes that can really move us away from corruption. I think that's what we need to do. But again, I would go back to my first answer, which is, if there's the anecdotal part of it and you have to act, you cannot see that and not do anything, no? But in the other hand, you have to think higher and to think more structurally how to address those issues in order for them not to happen, no?
Thank you, Vanessa. Lots of hands up. I think Juan Paulo is next, and then Denis.
Thanks, Andres. Thanks, Vanessa. I want to ask about what you told us before regarding clientelism. I fully agree about the need to extract those practices, and especially when them goes to the most poor people. But at the same time, I think that maybe in a government, it's not all only about specific policies, but also about a long-term project, which you want to be sustainable politically. And I think that you can't only be focused on doing a good job implementing technically perfect policies. You also need to get reelected, maybe. And so I think that it's a very difficult balance, not being clientelist, but being strategic enough to have a project that can survive the next election. What how do you think that balance can be achieved?
Again, very, very good question, Juan Pablo. I think that there is a huge difference between performing well with a good social policy that has technical base and that is successful, and being rewarded by those benefited by the policies, or those that see that you are doing well on those policies through the elections. That's one thing, and that's the right way to do it. And the other way to do it is to make it transactional. And by transactional, I mean the social support against a vote. They are very different perspectives. So I agree with the first part. I don't agree with the second part. The second part almost touches like conditionality of social policies for the vulnerable people and for the poor. We cannot allow that to happen. What we should do, and in order for this to be medium and long-term and not short-term, we need to give access to rights. We need to make this less transactional. I mean, some people, you need to deliver food. With some people, you need to deliver medicines, and that's fine. But that's juncture, that's short-term. What you need to do is to make that these people have access to basic social rights, which is food, which is education, which is housing, which is electricity, which is gas. So they are very different perspectives, and you need to draw a line. What I am against with is that you make it transactional, and this happens in my country, and it happens in many countries, no? Which is, I give you the support, and then I expect your vote. That is unacceptable, no? It's different to give rights and people, you know, rewarding you with votes. That's a complete different idea, and that's positive. And as one person told me, I had lunch with a very relevant politician in Mexico, and I told her, well, I think I like public policy making. I hadn't even entered into politics by then. So I told her I like public policy making more than politics, which is what you do, I was telling my interlocutor. And she said, yeah, but in order for you to make public policy, I need to win elections. And I was like, you're totally right. No, that's the deal, that's the deal. But just that red line that I was talking about Juan Pablo, I think that makes a huge difference. Not to make it transactional, and never expect, you know, giving a social policy or giving a social right and expecting a vote for that. That's my only concern.
Thank you, Vanessa. These are fascinating topics. We could go on for a long time. I'd be tempted to ask questions, but I will be disciplined. Denis, Mohammed, and then Tony. Keep it short, guys, because we have about 12, 15 minutes to go. Make sure everybody gets to speak up.
Yes, thank you, Andre. Thank you, Vanessa. I'm also from Mexico, and I was lucky enough to work at Coneval. Uh-huh. And I guess my issue there was that, for example, Coneval and, you know, the economics ministry or the education ministry, they all work towards the same goal, but it seems like in meetings and so on, and the exchange we had in emails, like there was a lot of, yeah, bureaucracy, I think, and also like power relations. So even though we worked towards the same goal, there was still like this, it was a bit tiring because everyone wanted to do their own thing. So I was just wondering if you encountered that and how, like, how would you solve it?
Thank you, Denny. Qué bueno conocerte. I think that yes, you will always find bureaucracy. You will always find power relations. It's intrinsic to not even to public sector, to public sector, private sector, to humans, no? And the way I think to move forward, and I found a lot of these in Coneval. When I was Deputy Minister of Social Affairs, I went there once a month for their meetings, and I presided some of their meetings. I think you have to create, it's again, creating the right incentives to move forward. Forgetting about bureaucracy or doing whatever it takes from bureaucracy, but not to invade, you know, the space of public policy and results. So be results oriented, be focused, and engage people, make them owners of the project, no? And I think that should be, you know, the right path forward. I was able to move that way when I worked with Coneval, but what we had in mind were the numbers of poverty, no? We don't want 7.5 people living in extreme poverty in Mexico. What we can do about that? And then maybe bureaucracy is second or third or last to that, no? When you have those compelling objectives, no one can say, no, but we have to fill in a paper before, no? So I guess just having the focus right and giving the right incentives when you participate. I think that would be my short message because we have few time.
Mohammed, floor is yours.
Thank you, Andres. Thank you, Vanessa. A quick, very, very quick question back to corruption. When would you think is a situation where a government altogether or an organization within it is too corrupt to be associated with, or if it's, you know, time for you to step down? If that would ever happen. And because you obviously earlier mentioned that if there's anything you can do, you would do it. So I don't assume you're a quitter, but just in general, would that situation ever come to happen?
That's not, you said it was an easy question. It was not an easy question. I would need some more time to answer that. And we can exchange ideas after this forum, if you want, Mohammed, on this. I think what you need to feel is safe, secure, and comfortable in the organization you're working for. It is not you you're not the judiciary, and you're not the judge, and you're not the ones that need to pursue a corruption act. If you see a corruption act, you need to denounce it in your immediate context. But if you hear on the media, but if you hear on the social media, I mean, it's there. But at the end, what you need to focus in when those aspects are judicialized and when the guilty, in case there's guilty, have their punishment. So I think there's a huge corruption problem, but we also need to know how to distinguish when there is indeed a corruption problem or where are political reasons behind the corruption narrative today, no? So I think that it's very easy. The difference is the law. And if someone thinks someone is corrupt, then they need to denounce him or her, and then they need to prosecute it. And you need to wait for the judges to present their case and for the judiciary to work and for the laws and regulations to work. We cannot work based on what the media says or what the social media says. We need to work on facts, and facts are also legal facts and judicial facts. So that would be my short answer for this. And you need to feel comfortable, I would say, in the organization you work for, in the with the people you work for, as long as you feel that that's a right environment, that's fine. But the minute you feel that there are corruption cases that are worth, you know, seeking in your immediate environment, or that fall into your tenure, your capabilities, your legal mandate, then you need to act. But in some cases, you just hear the noise. It can be noise, or it can be fact. But you're not in the position to prosecute. You're not in the position to denounce. Mm-hmm. No, you need to separate that.
Very good question. Difficult question. Good answer. Thank you. But you know, these are issues I'm sure we'll be talking about again and again and again. They don't go away. Professor Travers, the floor is yours.
Well, first, it's great to see you, Vanessa. I hope we'll all be able to meet properly soon. I mean, Andres and Adnan and I and others talk from time to time about, and Andres's question at the beginning sort of touched on this, about what we call the craft of government, the thing that you can only, in some ways, it's not you can only learn by doing, but when you were in government as a minister, and it does relate back to something Andres asked, what was the, when you had an official working with you, what was the thing that made you think this is the kind of skill set I want? What, these are the kind of people or the things that they can do for me that make my life easier as a minister, as a senior member of a government? What is it that you want the people around you to offer you when you're in that kind of high profile, high stress job?
Thank you, Tony. And yes, I look forward to meeting you in person. We've seen each other many times through these means. But I would say that it wouldn't be like one person having it all, but rather the group that you organize around that comprise your team. So perhaps from one person, you would like more analytical skills, but in another person, you would like to have more, communication skills. So I think that the more diverse and holistic a group you have, that people that work with you, the better for you, because you have different visions, you also need to have people that differentiate ideologically from each other, no? I had people that believed that Pemex had to be nationalized, and I had people that believed that Pemex had to be open to markets and to privatization. But you need to have those two visions, and then you have to make up your mind. But if you only are around people that think like you think, and that have your same mindset, and that have your same skills, then you won't have a diversity of inputs to be the proper catalyzing box to give the best policy output you can give. So I would say that it's not like one specific skill, but rather the mix of skills in many people, but also having different perspectives in your team. So you don't have like a single mind, embedded in the milieu of your team. So I would say that, but in general, it would be people that are analytical, people that are innovative, people that that want more, that want change, people that speak up their minds, no? I think that's what you would like to have in a team that moves you forward rather than stays in the status quo or wants to go, back. So I think those are the kind of skills that you look into people. And when people that work in the public sector that are my friends now, they're ministers or they're deputy ministers, I think that's what they look for. They want someone proactive. They want someone who thinks and speaks of their mind. So and that thinks differently, that thinks outside the box. Those are the new leaders that I think people are looking in organizations to move the needle, no?
I mean, just listening to you, it's very thoughtful, very helpful, and very important. I mean, I Remember when Mrs. Thatcher was prime minister in the UK, she used to say to one of her ministers, David Young, who's still around, said, David brings me solutions. Everyone else brings me problems.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting observation. Bring me solutions. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
That's actually a very important point Tony made at the end. Not only because solutions are better than problems, but because when you want to see your boss, you know, your boss has enough problems. If your boss thinks that you only bring him or her problems, the boss will say, oh yeah, come see me, you know, 2 months from now. So if you want an appointment soon, make sure that you bring a solution. Vanessa was saying that you want people with a diverse set of skills. That's true. I would add, however, that you want just a modicum of political skills and common sense in everybody. I had a really, really brilliant advisor. I may have told the story before. If you've heard it, forgive me. My brilliant advisor, a guy with a graduate degree from Stanford, an absolute genius. We were doing a very complicated financial reform. We went to Congress. The head of a finance committee asked a really stupid question, which revealed, of course, that he had not read the legislation. And my advisor began his answer by saying, sir, if you had read the bill in question, you wouldn't be asking that. I don't have to tell you that's not the thing you say to a member of parliament. It is true the question was stupid. It is true that, the parliamentarian in question had not done his homework, but you never rub it in their faces, right? You don't say it is evident you haven't read it. I mean, it was evident already. You didn't have to make that point. Get up your political skills, guys, because, otherwise you will never again be taken to parliament. That's what I did with my advisor. I sent him to the basement where he did a very good job running regressions, but, he was not the kind of person that you would take to Congress. Professor Khan is going to have the last word, or actually the last question, I presume.
Thank you, Andres. I'm tempted to also respond to the previous conversation. So, that Tony and Andres had. I completely agree with the solution-based interventions, but I'm always mindful of people coming with solutions. I always prefer people with coming with well-defined problems for which we can start looking for solutions. But that was more of an aside. So Vanessa, excellent presentation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much. You had a great response on the question of corruption. I have a quick follow-up question, which is on questions where policymakers may have, their intentions may not be bad, but the policies are bad and still stick for a long time and are harder to change. So one famous example being Santiago Levy for Mexico, his book is titled Good Intentions, Bad Outcomes, about suboptimal welfare and labor market policies. So any advice or any insight on why these policies persist and what can be done about this?
Yes, Adnan, I think there's sometimes that you have good intentions and bad outcomes, but I think you need to expect good intentions and good outcomes as well. Maybe not the optimal one, because sometimes the optimal is far from possible, no? But I think you should expect the most optimal in the context of possibility, no? I don't believe that, I think that good policies are good policies, and that policies can evolve over time. And I would mention something here very, very relevant. The current government in Mexico is a very different government from the ones before. At the beginning, perhaps we thought that it was more a left government. It has proved to be more a populistic government, some signs of authoritarianism there. And they don't agree with previous policies. Previous policies, I'm not speaking only about the previous government, but the previous 20, 30 years. And you can be against some policies. What you cannot do is get there without a plan and just destroy what was there without having a viable option to change it for. So my idea is that yes, policies could have been perfectible and policies could have been wrong and they need to be overhauled and they need to be changed, and that's fine. But they need to be changed for the better, no? And they need to be measured. So one of my last presentations in Congress, during my administration, we were always criticized by how low growth was in Mexico, no? The year I was a deputy minister of finance, 2.3%. But I always told the new government, yes, but 2.3% is much better than minus 0.8, no? Which was the first year without COVID. So I am not an ideological, and I am not, I don't think anything should be written on stone, and I'm open to change, just to change for the better. And numbers, and as Denis was mentioning, Coneval and independent institutions and technical institutions have to certify that. That's why, therefore, we need to grow more, we need to have less poverty, we need to, and if we're improving, fine, chapeau, no? There are different ways to achieving goals. But I just think that yes, there are good intentions and bad outcomes, but there are also good intentions and good outcomes that can be perfectible over time.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
All right, everybody. We thank Vanessa. We thank everyone. We are at minus 5 minutes. So I would carry on, but I suspect people want to have dinner or do other things. So please join me in giving Vanessa a virtual round of applause.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. You know, one day we will go back to having meetings in person. So when we do the policy and practice things after the talk, we will have a drink or a cup of something. Regrettably, that is not going to be the case now, or at least, you know, I'm going to have a drink, but it will not be in the company of you. But it will be in the company of all of you, I hope, sooner rather than later. So thank you, Vanessa.
Thanks,
Adnan. Thanks, Tony. Thanks, everybody, all the students who joined the call. And we will see you soon at another Policy in Practice seminar. Good evening, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.